The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
The Road Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello again, welcome to another edition of the Round Golf Podcast. First up, a big thank you to you for that amazing response to the John Morgan podcast in particular. After we've heard from Christy Kerr, I'm going to go through some of the feedback that we've had from it. It really has been astonishing. Thank you for that. And also an apology as well to you, and I'll tell you why in a moment, and to Christy Kerr herself, because without going into too many details, and don't worry, it doesn't spoil the interview, had a bit of a technical nightmare. Anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. She was great, she was patient, she stuck with me for the interview, and to her, thank you, and to you as well, because there was one or two things that we lost the initial response for because we had to go back and do it again. But as I say, it's still a great interview with what is, after all, an incredibly strong and successful woman. Her major triumphs, her amateur brilliance, her sufferings in the early days as a pro all come out in this. There's the isolation, the lack of friendship, and the role her father played in all of that. We talk about how she transformed not just her game, but her whole outlook as well, an image, and of course the Solheim Cup and what that means to her. It's one of those interviews that starts slowly, but really does build and build. Hope you're going to enjoy. So Christy, we start with the round, and I actually hadn't heard from you just before we did the interview what it was going to be, but I had a good idea. So yeah, the 2007 US Open was a good guess by me, but yeah. I mean, it probably is an obvious place to be really in terms of a round that has the most significance in your career.
Yeah, it got me to a higher level in my game, and it showed me that I could win major championships and that I could perform under that amount of pressure. So I also beat the number one player in the world at the time. You know, there were a lot of firsts for me coming from that round, so pretty special.
Yeah, it took you a while to win your first tournament on the LPGA Tour, and it took you a little while to win your first major, that mm-hmm. being the US Open. Did that kind of make it more special that way, or would you have rather just got it out couple of years?
I mean, obviously wish you would have got it out of the way early, but yeah, I think it made it more special. You know, leading up to my first regular win, you know, I finished second, third, fourth a lot, and the same thing, you know, for major championships. One of the years where the US Open was at the Merritt Club in Chicago, I finished second at that Open, you know, so it was very sweet when it ended up happening.
It was a few months before your 30th birthday. You'd already won a number of times on the LPGA Tour, eight of them in the space of the last 3 years coming into this. And this was a golf course that already had special memories for you, Pine Needles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a low amateur in 1996. I made a 30-footer on the last hole to beat out Kelly Booth, we were good friends, but we were also rivals in the junior golf scene. Then I think it was 2001, I finished fourth.
So 2001, you finished fourth there. So you must have had a good feeling that this was a kind of golf course where, even though it was your 42nd major try, that it could be that this week.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I really loved the golf course and that I had had some success there. So, I mean, I didn't know it was going to be my week. I mean, I almost withdrew from the tournament because I hurt my knee, like walking into the fitness van on Thursday morning. So I gutted it out even to just be able to play on Thursday, shot even. Maybe that took the expectation off.
Yeah, it's funny as you say that. I mean, I've heard, and you should, I mean, you know, you've been in the game long enough, you've heard these stories a number of times where players basically think, am I going to tee it up? Padraig Harrington, for example, wasn't sure he was going to play the year he defended his Open title.
Yeah, I mean, I think mentally you get into a space where you're kind of just grateful to be there, and takes the pressure off, takes the expectation off, and you just sort of play golf instead of putting all this other stuff on it.
Tournaments don't always go to schedule. You had to finish your round, didn't you, on the Sunday morning, your third
round? Yeah, third round on Sunday morning. And I really just, you know, the third round, I think I had to finish Friday's round on Saturday morning and then played most of Saturday. Then I had to finish Saturday's round up on Sunday. And in that space of that period of time, I was 6 or 7 under, where nobody was really making a move. So I, you know, I cut a lot of ground with that.
Yeah, 66 in your third round. So final round, you mentioned you're playing with Lorena Ochoa, number one player at the time, and then the young upstart as she was then, Morgan Pressel, who just won a major that year, youngest ever. So, I mean, you were in some company there for that final round, and it was one of those that was pretty tight, it seemed, the whole way through.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you pretty much summed it up.
I heard that you didn't actually feel like you were actually playing very well.
No, I wasn't striking the ball very well, but I was getting the ball in the hole, which quite often I do. And you know, it wasn't until the last 5 holes where I found something, some key in my swing, just some kind of feel through the ball where I actually started striking the ball solidly. So I just managed, you know, and that's, you know, what I've done for a lot of my wins. You know, there's been very few of my wins where I've actually hit it great for an entire tournament.
You're not happy with the way you're striking, but you've been there before. Now, this putter that you're talking about, I understand it was something that was new in the bag and it came about in a strange kind of way.
But I bought it in a pro shop in Korea and used it in that Korean Open tournament, finished 2nd with it, and just loved it.
So this was how many weeks before?
I honestly can't
remember. A few weeks back, I think.
It had been just a few weeks.
Is this something
before.
You do normally?
No. No, it was just I was putting so poorly with the putter that I had that I needed something else. I just need to look at something else, and it wasn't an official LPGA tournament, so I just took a chance and found a putter, and I really loved it.
And the ball just kept disappearing. I mean, the 14th seemed like a keyhole to me
in
that final round.
It was. Yeah, I hit a 4-iron into the green. Just to even be able to get a 15-footer to get a look on that hole was amazing. And then, you know, I knew I had to make it to pull ahead, so I did.
And you made some crucial saves over the final few holes. When did, I mean, you had a 2-shot lead going to the last. When did you feel that this was going to be the moment, that this was going to be your day after all?
I mean, I think when Lorena hit, I hit in the fairway on 18, Lorena hit in the rough. You know, when I think she hit first from what I remember, and she hit it over the green, and I had a 9-iron into the green, and again, kind of hung on to one, but it, you know, it was just, it was kind of a little, just a little right of the hole on the front fringe. I was pretty confident at that point that I was going to take the championship. Although when she chipped it from over the green, she almost holed it out. So I would have had the 2-putt to win by a shot. But, you know, she ended up getting up and down, and I ended up 2-putting to win by 2 shots. So I knew on the 17th hole when she had topped it out of the bunker and I hit it on the green, like having a 2-shot lead going to the last hole is a lot better than a 1-shot lead.
And what was it, elation, joy, relief? What did you feel? I know it's a little while.
Everything, all at once. It was relief. It was this great sense of accomplishment. It was joy. It was just an outpouring of emotion. It was pretty cool.
This is your national championship.
Yeah. This, and I think I was only the 6th or 7th American to win it in 50, you know, the last 50 years or something.
You grew up in Florida, and you knew pretty early on you wanted to be a golf professional. How young were you?
Yeah, you know, I would watch all the great American golfers on TV, and I mean, it looked really hard what they were doing, but it looked like fun as well, and I knew from a very early age that I wanted to do this.
Okay, I mean, 9, 10 years old, I mean, that's quite early to know what you want to do for the rest of your life, isn't it?
I mean, it was something that I felt like I could be really good at. I wasn't good at it from the beginning, but I don't know, something in me clicked about golf and watching golf on TV, and it looked like fun.
And playing golf and knowing you wanted to do it, what was it fun for you, even in those early years? I mean, how much did you love playing golf?
No, I loved it. And it was really, really difficult. And there were a lot of challenges. Obviously, my family didn't have a lot of money. And I had to play on the boys team in high school. Growing up the way I did, I mean, I was fortunate that I had the Dade Amateur Golf Association, which I could go and play for free and get lessons. And Charlie DeLuca, who's my godfather now, he used to run the, and they still do the Doral Publix Junior Classic, which was before the Orange Bowl. So I always got to play in that. So I was fortunate to have people in my life that would help me along, even though we didn't have a lot of money.
That high school team, playing in a boys' team, that must have been, in some respect, a difficult thing, and not everyone wanted you around, did they?
No, I mean, people are afraid of what they don't understand, and, you know, who's this girl playing against the guys, and, you know, I was very good from a very young age, and my high school team did not have a girls' team, so it was either sink or swim. You know, you play with the boys, and you play all the way from the back tees, even if they don't want you to be there, you do it, you sink or swim, you survive or you quit. So I was able to survive.
Because you're talking about how much you enjoy playing the game. That, in some respect, you would understand if a young girl found that not so enjoyable, not wanting to be there, you know, not being wanted first.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, my mother's family's from Sicily, so they're very fiery and determined. And, you know, my father was a baseball player and had that athletic background as well. So I feel like I had that determined sense of me even from a very young age. And, you know, if somebody told me I couldn't do something, I wanted to do it twice as much. So I thrived in that kind of an environment, which a lot of people don't.
And you did thrive. Your amateur record, mm-hmm. Unbelievable. Curtis Cup as an 18-year-old. You know, we mentioned already the US Open, top mm-hmm. amateur there. You won tournament after tournament, and you turned pro, having won 22 of your previous 25 amateur tournaments. An outstanding record. Were you proud of all that you'd achieved as an amateur, or were you just focused on, it's another step?
Yeah, it was another step. I mean, obviously, I feel like I'm more proud of it now because I have perspective and I appreciate what I was going through. But yes, back then it was like steps to get to an end goal. And didn't really help me a lot when I came out on tour, and, you know, playing against this level of talent out here, you know, I had that kind of like false bravado kind of sense about me where it was kind of false hope. All these accomplishments, I thought I was going to come out and be a world beater, but I was not.
Well, you say false hope. Most people would have said, look at what she's done in the amateur game.
Right.
You know, there's someone who's...
Right, but expectations are a funny thing.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it did more harm than good then?
No, I mean, I had confidence to do everything that I had done. I knew how to win all these things, but I came out expecting to just be a world beater and underestimated the level of talent there is on this tour.
So what do you think? Could you put your finger on what went wrong in those early years?
No, I had a lot of family problems, drama. My parents were getting divorced. You know, I was... gained a lot of weight and got really heavy, didn't have a good first year. If it wasn't for my family in New York and Long Island, I wouldn't have had the money to keep going and go back to Q school, and, you know, had that pressure taken off of me to be able to move on and travel by myself and to evolve as a person and just keep steadily getting better over, you know, those first 4 or 5 years. Those were crucial years for me, and without my family in New York to support me, I would have never survived.
Your dad played a big influence in those early days for you. I've read that and heard that it wasn't always a positive thing for you. You guys were arguing a little bit
days. Yeah, I mean, he traveled with me and he caddied for me, and that wasn't, I think we were too close. You know, it wasn't the best thing for me at the time, but we were trying to save money. So it was kind of a double-edged sword. You know, but it wasn't until I took control of my life and said, I need to do this on my own and you need to go figure things out with my mom. And until I took control of my life, my career did not start to turn around.
Because when you came out, you were this brash young kid. We mm-hmm. mentioned that you had something behind you to talk big, but that wasn't just you talking.
No, my, you know, you monkey see, monkey do in a way. And, you know, my dad obviously believed in me more than anybody, but it, you know, sometimes he let other people know that too much, and, you know, I was always listening and learning from him, and, you know, maybe I parroted, you know, some things too much.
How long before you realized that was a negative influence for you and that you had to do something about that?
Well, I mean, I got a lot of negative press about it in the beginning, and until you grow up and until years have gone by and you can look at your life and say, well, who do you want to become and who do you want people to remember you as, and those kinds of things, those kinds of thoughts come up. You don't grow up. I had to grow up, and I didn't get to grow up in college. I grew up on the tour under a microscope, so, you know, it was hard.
It was. It must have been difficult to make friends.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't let a lot of people in, just my personality. I have my core group of friends, and I'm very loyal to them, and they see this other side of me, but, you know, I'm very intense on the golf course, and that can be misread by a lot of people.
Sure, because obviously you're a human being after all, but what you're doing out there is trying to achieve something. And it must have been very frustrating as someone who had great achievement as an amateur suddenly turning pro, and suddenly it seemed a very different ball game at all.
Yeah, I mean, I was going up against veterans who'd been out there for 20 years, and I mean, I just thought golf is golf, you know. I did great here, I'm going to do great there, and it just didn't turn out that way in the beginning.
Do you remember the conversation with your dad saying that it's time for you to go alone?
Yeah, I'd rather not get into that.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't a pleasant one.
The fact that you don't want to talk about it, I think, says all that needs to be said about it, really.
Who wants to talk about them arguing, you know, you arguing with your parents over stuff, whether it's the boyfriend or girlfriend that you can have or whatever, or having a car or moving out or whatever it is.
So without the specifics, it was an important moment, though, in terms of what happened then for the rest of
your
career.
Yeah, I remember it. I remember it. I had to go out on my own. I had to make my own way, forge my own way, become the person I wanted to be. And I could not do that with somebody telling me what to do.
And in a way, you reinvented yourself, not just in terms of going alone and looking after your own game, but also in the way you looked as well.
Yeah, and I had to get fit because I was getting a lot of injuries with my back and my neck. And you have to walk a lot in golf. You have to be fit. You know, if you want to be an athlete and be winning tournaments, you can't be exhausted all the time. So, yeah, I took my health into my own hand. Well, for health reasons too, right? So I went to a nutritionist and learned about food. I mean, I thought, you know, fast food was good food, you know, back then.
But if you don't know any different.
You don't know any different, yeah, but it's also what you're taught as a kid, right? So I had to go and see a nutritionist, trainer, and, you know, I wrote down everything I ate for 7 years. I didn't have a French fry for 7 years. That's pretty impressive now that I look back on that.
Sure. I mean, am I right in saying that you took abuse growing up for the way you looked? Is that true? I've read that.
I mean, kids are cruel in school. Like, call you four eyes or fatty or whatever. I mean,
you say whatever. I mean,
kids bully kids. I mean, that's what they do. Even in today's day and age, there's just a lot more awareness for kids getting bullied. But yeah, I mean, I got made fun of all the time. I was the last one on the dodgeball team to get picked. You know, it's all this regular stuff, but I'm laughing at them now.
That's going to say, look at me now.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'm not the most fit person in the world, but I'm laughing at them.
I understand as well the other side of it as well, I can't say an amusing way, but you had to change your whole wardrobe. So, I mean, it was just a whole complete lifestyle change.
Yeah, but I mean, first and foremost, I did it for myself because I didn't want to have a heart attack when I was 40 years old.
You know? People didn't recognize you? You had to change your driver's license, that sort of thing?
I mean, I changed over several years, so
sure.
I think a lot of people were like, oh, that's not you anymore. And yeah, I did. I looked very different. I used to have a perm in my hair and glasses, and I lost all this weight. My hair is long now with, you know, so I'm sure that there was a lot of that.
Sure, and it did have a benefit on your game. I mean, it took...
For sure.
And it took 6 years in coming for that win, but...
Yeah, but I mean, it was worth it.
I mean, that time when you won that first tournament, the journey that you'd been through, I mean, there must, you know, we talked about the US Open win as well, but that first victory that you had as well.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was actually with a caddy named Greg Sheridan, and he passed away this year from brain cancer. Mm. And he was Natalie Gulbis's longtime caddy. Yeah, I won my first event with him, and he was Beth Daniels' longtime caddy. And, you know, after we won, he hugged me and said, "Way to go, kid. I knew you could do it. This is going to be the first of many." And I don't even know if I believed him at that point because it took me 6 years to win a golf tournament. But
he was right.
He was right.
He was right.
God rest his soul.
Yeah, and the same year you qualified for your first Solheim Cup. as well.
Pretty special.
Yeah, because you were
hard to believe I already played nine.
I
like
know.
That's like over half my life.
Sohan Cups. It's played a big part of your life, hasn't it, Sohan?
Yeah, it's a thrill. You know, the first couple of years I put a lot of pressure on myself, but when I was kind of like, hey, this is an exhibition to grow the game of women's golf, just go and let it all hang out, like I started playing great. Don't get me wrong, it's a lot of pressure, but if you compartmentalize it the right way and for the right reasons, you can really shine in that.
Watching you on the course, the fact you just used the word exhibition. I don't want to take it out of the wrong context, but it seems like it means a lot more to you.
Oh, for sure it is. It is 100%, but it is that. And it is on a stage to grow the game of women's golf. So put on a good show for them, you know, like do that.
Yeah, I mean, you just missed out in 2000.
Yeah, I actually three-putted the last qualifying hole for that entire 2 years. Had I two-putted, I would have made it on points, but I three-putted and I wasn't a pick. Because I can understand it now. I mean, Pat Bradley didn't want to pick a rookie going over to Loch Lomond, so.
At that time, you must have been, you know, with everything.
I was mad. I was mad I didn't get picked because I had 8 top tens that year. In 1 year, I basically almost qualified for the team in 1 year. And I didn't get picked, but now seeing all the captains that I've played under and seeing how Solheim is, I wouldn't have picked me either.
I know there's a lot of good golf in you, but you surely you're Solheim Cup captain material yourself.
I think it'd be a blast. I think I'd be way more nerve-wracked being the captain than actually playing because it's out of your control, right? All you do is put your teams in and your lineups and, you know, there's a little more than that, obviously, with talking to your team and trying to inspire them, et cetera, but... It's definitely something I want to do.
And of course, you've played under one of your heroes growing up was Julie Inkster as well, and you played under her, and you kind of been inspired those last two Solheims playing under her. Your record has been, I mean, it was pretty good beforehand, but those last two Solheims, 2015, 2017.
She brings out the best in you.
Why?
I don't know. She just put your work hat on, go to work, play for each other, play for the person next to you, play for yourself. She makes you proud, you know. It's not that you're proud to be an American, but she makes you really proud. Like, you don't let Julie Inkster down, ever. You know, I remember being 3 down after 4 holes in Germany, and she showed her face, and I was like, oh, God, I better not lose this match, you know. So I just went on, put the turbochargers on, and just got it done.
You brought up Germany, and interesting in a way that, you know, you say to produce something that's great for the game, women's golf. I mean, there was that Sunday morning was a little sour, maybe not the best for women's golf.
No, and that's unfortunate for Suzanne because she's going to have to live with that for the rest of her life. But it inspired us. Certainly, it lit a fire under our ass as a team.
And I bet you were one of those that were getting the team together.
I felt bad for her.
For who?
For Suzanne, I felt bad for her. I had sympathy because...
Why?
Was I mad? I was mad, and I was mad for our team because it felt very unfair, but I felt bad for her because you knew the storm that was coming after that for her.
Sure.
And you knew that she was going to have to live with it for the rest of her life, and you knew that that's going to follow her around forever. So I felt bad for her, but at the same time still wanted to beat her and beat her team. So I went out and I did my job. It was an interesting morning.
Yes. And you forged this partnership with Lexi Thompson. What's it like, you know, now being this elder stateswoman playing with these girls that, I mean, in Lexi's case, half your age?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, I wish I was 20 again, don't get me wrong, but I like the place that I'm in, and I like that people respect me, and because I respect them, you know? You have to give respect to get it. And it's been a blast to play with Lexi. We fight for each other. And I think that's what you need in a partner. No matter if you're 2 down with 2 to go, you know, I'm telling her, walking up there, I don't care, we'll chip this in. Come on. We're not out of this yet. You know, like you have to, I think that's why I play so well with Lexi, because I'm a little bit of a coacher and she fights for me and I fight back for her. And it's unique. It's cool to have had that in my life.
I'm sure. And it seems to me, and I don't know this for fact, and I haven't, you know, it seems to me, though, like you're the person that, you know, it's got the target on your head in terms of the European team. They want to beat you because you're kind of this talismanic figure now.
That's fine.
In the American team. Do you actually enjoy that?
That's fine. I mean, if they want to give that much power, that's fine. I mean, why not?
Are you aware of that?
Yeah, it's fine. I don't mind wearing that hat.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Sure.
It's fine. Who cares?
And you come up, I mean, the walking in the putts, I mean, that's something...
I've done that my whole life, though. Yeah. I've done that since I was 10 years old. So it's not something that you teach somebody. It's just, I don't do it on purpose. I just do it. When I try to walk in putts, it never happens.
So you hadn't seen anyone do that before. It's just something that came naturally to you then.
No, it's in. Go get it. Like, I don't know where I got it from.
And also, I mean, as you know, from a commentary point of view, you're great entertainment before the shot, during the shot. In other words, I can actually shut up for a couple of minutes.
You know, Dottie Pepper was always one of the players that I really, really admired looking, you know, growing up. And she always talked to her ball. And I, like, kind of always just kind of followed that. And I found it interesting, you know. So I just started doing it from a young age and just stuck with me.
In terms of coaches, mental coaches, all these, have you dabbled in all these sort of things?
Oh, I've worked with all the different mental coaches there are out there because I like making my mind the strongest part of my game. Because golf will beat you down. But you have to be able to bring yourself back. So I've worked with Rotella, I've worked with Dr. Joe Parent, I've worked with Fran Perzolo, you know, all the great ones, because I'm interested in learning about the mind, because I don't want the mind to be something that is a hindrance. Because I can grind it out even when I'm not playing well.
Like the US Open that you won in 2007.
If you're mentally strong and determined, you can do it. But if your mind is weak and you think, I'm only going to play well when I hit it great, you're going to have a very short career.
Sure. I mean, yeah. you have had one of those weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The LPGA Championship 2010.
Yeah, I mean,
was that surreal?
An amazing place with my technique and my swing and my short game, putting, everything, but also mentally they aligned. So that's one of those Zen experiences that may only come around a couple times in a career at best.
And you can appreciate that that's not something you can attain every time.
Yeah.
To win a major by 12, obviously.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
I mean, you're up there with only a few people to have done that, men and women.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, and I knew when I was going through it, I was very aware of my mental state of mind, and I was very aware of where I was and where I could take that week, and I did it, which is really, really impressive.
Yeah.
Even to me, it's really, really impressive.
That young girl that, you know, had to go through all that process of life on tour to start with.
Obviously was meant to be.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it made you who you are.
And, yes.
And
all of the stairs I've climbed up have led to this point. All of the things that have knocked me off of a pedestal and all the claws to climb back, like all of those things have made me who I am.
And people would look
at... And I'm certainly not perfect. I've got plenty of human, you know, things I struggle with. But
flaws. We've all got flaws.
Yeah, but at 40 years of age now, I'm just truly starting to appreciate my career. But I don't feel like I'm done. I feel like I've just started working on other stuff in my swing now because I feel like I'm not done.
Interesting, because you've recently had a second child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so people might think you may be thinking about maybe reducing the workload a little bit, but not...
I think I'm not going to work more. I think I'm going to work smarter to get more out of my practice, to get more out of the tournaments that I play. I mean, Lexi, last year, she only played 18 golf tournaments, and she almost won Player of the Year, and I think I just need to work smarter. I can be home more, but I can work harder and train more and be smarter.
And we look at this fighter's attitude. You've had to fight. I mean, I've written down a list of things, you know, the prejudice you had to come in the high school boys team.
Yeah.
You talked about the breakup of your parents' marriage. We haven't really talked about how you had to, you know, look after your mother. I mean, that must have been, you know,
yeah, I mean, my mom's pretty self-sufficient, but yeah, that those few years that we went through was really tough.
But that's a life-defining thing for you, because you've mm-hmm. you know, you've created your own foundation and,
yep.
and things from yeah, that experience.
That was like the first thing that really gave me purpose outside of golf. And I think I started playing better because it was like, golf is not life and death. You know, golf is a game that can be mastered and played and faltered at, but it's not life and death, you know? And I think that when I separated those things and put them in one hand and the other hand and looked at them, golf became less scary. So golf can be scary sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you say scary, I mean, what you think it's going to all be finished and done with? I mean, what are you...
No, golf can be scary. You're
scared
of
what?
You focus on results so much that you can go in one way if you let yourself, like a lot of people have, you know? So golf can be... People can confuse their own self-worth with their results. And oftentimes, as professional golfers, we do that. But when I looked at it and said, I am not what my golf score is, Golf is not scary. Golf is a game to be enjoyed and played and to get angry at, and but to still go out there the next day and tee it up again. Like, when I started looking at golf like that, I started playing better.
And you're a wife, a mother, you've raised over $3 million for Birdies for Cancer.
Yeah.
You're the CTO, is that how you describe yourself?
Chief Tasting Officer, yeah.
Of your wine company.
It's a fun title.
Yeah, I mean, the wine thing, is that something that just grew over the years with you, or is it something...
Well, we had a tournament in Napa Valley, like the late 90s, early 2000s, the Samsung World Championship of Women's Golf, and you had to qualify to get into it, so it was like a top 30 event, only 30 people in the tournament, and... You know, I was lucky enough to play in that 4 or 5 times in a row, and it was in Napa. So I just fell in love with the area and the wine, and I'm actually studying to be a sommelier as well. I passed my level 1 sommelier about 1.5 years ago.
Wow.
So, I mean, I don't work in the wine industry every day, tasting wines, trying wines. So it's a lot harder. It's going to be a lot slower for me to get to sommelier just because I have to actually buy the wines to try them. I'm not in the industry where you get access to a lot of these different wines to try. But I've got great people that want to mentor me, that are master sommeliers or, you know, stars of the movie Som, you know, that you've seen. And yeah, it's a passion for me. And I've always wanted to do something outside of golf. And you don't make any money in the charity business. You give the money away, right? So we created a business.
Is there a bit of that the young Christy Kerr, you know, as the kid, the golfer, the passion you had there, mm-hmm. now, you know, over the years, it became a business and a life and a...
Yeah, I mean, when I obviously met my husband and then developed over many years our relationship, like, we both had found that we had a mutual love for business. And he was involved in a bunch of different businesses in New York City, and I wanted to do something besides golf because you can't play golf forever, right? So we somehow stumbled into this. And it's the oldest joke in the book. How do you make $1 million in the wine business? You start with 3. And we've put a lot of our own money into this. And we're finally getting somewhere with the scores in our wines. And, you know, we have a professional business plan now and a lot of things going on. So it's exciting.
Well, once again, what a story, really. Christy Kerr, an amazing woman. And I'm sure she will once again be a hard lady to beat when it comes to the Solheim Cup at Gleneagles in September in Scotland. There's been fantastic feedback from you from all of the podcasts, and I'd love to hear what you've got to make of the Christy Kerr one. You can do so at The Round Golf Podcast on Facebook and at The Round Podcast on Twitter. Now, some of the response, I wanted to get some of this feedback that you gave on John Morgan. Here's a few of your thoughts. Kevin Davis said he's just listened. What a top man. Very sad, but also funny. Totally inspiring to any young sportsman. Love to meet this guy one day. Rich, who's on CM222 on Twitter, says definitely the best yet, and all of them have been great. What a great guy John Morgan is. Love his outlook on life. Ian Bergen, the Round's a great series, but there are a few episodes that really stand out, and this is one of them. Plenty of laughs and a few holy bleeps moments too. I've no idea about these health issues. Great stuff, guys. Keep them coming. I like this one from Oakis Golf. He said his wife's not into golf at all. Listened to the whole interview. Said, for me personally, it's amazing since I had a similar story and ended up playing professional basketball for 15 years. Now golf has got the bug. Sean Smith, what a story. Had me smiling, laughing and grimacing all at the same time. Michael Jordan, we had a basketball listener just there, didn't we? I don't think it's the real one, though. Well, it is the real one, but not that one, you get what I mean. It says, brilliant podcast, it was so good. I sat outside the house in the car for 20 minutes listening after the drive home from work. Now, there's dedication for you. Corley, just listen to the John Morgan podcast, one of the weirdest, but arguably the best stories I've ever heard. Imagine what could have been. And Mark Taggart says, wow, what a story. An amazing life led to its fullest with plenty and twists and turns along the way. Thinks that's my favorite from both series. There was loads more as well. Thank you so much for getting in touch. Thanks so much for your feedback as well. Keep them coming. Give us a rating as well. That really helps things too. And also, big thanks to our sponsors, Navigate Contracting and Red Ray. Until the next time.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.